Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Hi there, Lauren.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Noel. Hello. All right, good. We got everybody now.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Really well.
Well, today I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about some listener-requested topics, but we've really had a lot of listener requests piling up lately.
Yeah, which is fantastic,
yes.
Guys. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
So we love it. We're not complaining, but...
Yeah, they're only piling because you're so fabulous.
Yes, and we can only record and publish 2 episodes a week.
Yes.
But so today we thought, you know what we should do? We should do a listener mail roundup episode.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, even in this episode, we're not going to be able to get to every one of the things y'all have sent us that we want to talk about. But we wanted to pick some of the topics that could be addressed in a slightly shorter form and take them on all at once.
And some of these may eventually become part of an episode. Episode where we take a deeper dive into these. But a lot of the questions seemed like they would have a fairly quick answer that wouldn't justify a full-length episode, which is why we kind of grouped them together. They're not grouped by any sort of theme either, because you'll see as we go on, it's kind of all over the place, which is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our first listener suggestion that we want to get to today actually came to us on our Facebook wall. It was our listener, Ed, who asked us about the future of media delivery. And Ed said... Podcast idea. I want my MP3 or LP or VOD. I think that's an I want my MTV joke for the kids who don't remember Dire Straits.
Yeah, or just MTV.
Right. Ed goes on, how will we be listening to or getting our music, watching movies, reading books and magazines and newspapers in the future? Well, I think this is a great question.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's a fantastic question. And it's one that, I mean... If I were being snarky, I would just say streaming and move on, because I think that that's really the answer to a lot of this. And it's an answer that's being pushed partly by consumer behavior and partly because it's a very attractive model for companies.
Sure. Well, we've got the resources in place, don't we? I mean, now that high-speed internet is becoming the norm, at least in some parts of the world and more of the world long term.
Sure.
It's kind of hard to argue against the power of streaming.
Well,
you have so much access and it takes up so little space.
Right. It wasn't that long ago that Wi-Fi was really the speed you would need in order to get decent streaming experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it was going to be a very low quality stream or you're going to buffer. So, you know, I remember the days of trying to listen to something on streaming and get 20 seconds in, and then suddenly the song stops and you wait another 15 seconds, then another 20 seconds of music plays. But now we've gotten to speeds of Wi-Fi. We've gotten better speeds of cellular service, and we've gotten better compression models for streaming media to allow that to happen where we don't have as frequent an issue with buffering. Still happens.
Oh, yeah.
Once in a blue moon, it happens on my connection at home, which is pretty fast. But...
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you've got to have that trifecta of a device that can handle it.
Right.
Connection that can handle
it.
And
the actual service.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if one of those three things is deficient, you're going to have a poor experience. But we've reached the point where the norm is that you can have this pretty seamlessly. Like my phone, now I can use my phone pretty much anywhere in Atlanta streaming a podcast. So I don't have to download an episode anymore. I can just stream it, and it caches enough of the podcast in local memory so that if I do pass through an area that has weak service, like, you know, I often take the train, and the train here in Atlanta, there's above ground sections and below ground.
Yeah.
So sometimes when you go below ground, you lose that connection, but the cache corrects for that, right? It has enough in the buffer so that I can keep listening without having that interruption. I think that because the technology has reached this point, streaming is really where a lot of this is going. It also means that we can listen or watch stuff when we feel like it. You know, we can, and a lot of those services also allow us to stop at one point and pick up at that same point, even as we switch devices. Mm-hmm. So if we go from TV to phone or tablet or whatever.
Yeah, I agree that digital playback is going to pretty much dominate. It's going to be king. I can't really see that changing for any good reason, except for the sort of small-scale collector aspect. I personally, I listen to records at my house sometimes, and I don't know why. I guess it's just fun. It can be fun to go record shopping, to put a record on the turntable. There's something aesthetically pleasing about it. It's mm-hmm. a fun activity, but I'd say most of my listening I do digitally, whether that's podcasts or, I mean, obviously for podcasts, but or music. Most of the movies I see now, I think, come to me in a digital form. And I don't know, do y'all think there's any reason that we'd see a major comeback of physical media for, say, music playback?
Nope.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, there is that nostalgia factor and that aesthetic pleasure that you get from, I mean, cassette tapes are a thing again. Who knew?
Are they really a thing again?
I do love them.
Are they?
I mean,
I know that there was the marketing gimmick of the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack coming back out on cassette. Are cassettes really coming back?
Yeah, no. Bands, like smaller local bands, are releasing some of their albums on cassette tape.
God, I love
that. You have to...
That's great.
Are there still still electronics companies selling cassette tape players?
Jonathan, you've got some blood running down your forehead.
Well, I mean, I'm like, look, guys, we're better than that now. I've left those days behind. Cassettes are not great media formats.
Yeah, but they're
it's,
fun.
It's,
come
it's
on.
A shtick. And a lot of older cars do still have cassette decks.
I guess so. I can understand. I do agree that it's a lot easier to form kind of that emotional attachment to something when there's a physical representation of that thing, right?
Totally.
Like, I have a vinyl record collection, and there is a particular feeling I get when I pull an album out of that collection, put it on a turntable, listen to it.
Yeah, the ritual of it is kind of lovely.
Exactly. Yeah, there is a ritual that's associated with it that's very comforting, and it's all part of the experience. Which you can't, you know, you can't really place a quantitative value on, but it's certainly.
I never get that warm fuzzy when I like open iTunes.
Yeah, exactly.
And like browse. To,
yeah. When I open up my Google Radio playlist that's based off the album that I really love. Yeah. I mean, it's not the same thing. So I don't want to dismiss the value of physical media, but I think that. Because there is the incentive on the part of the media companies to maximize profits, which you certainly can do if you don't have to have a physical presence anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to create inventory. You don't have to have a place to move that inventory. You don't have to worry about inventory loss if someone steals your physical stuff and you can no longer sell it. I could see a lot of reasons why companies would shy away from it, and this could become something that we see more on a special case-by-case basis as entities, whether it's an author or a band or whatever, are catering to their audience.
One way I do see this changing, though, is that I think laser discs are going to come back in a big way.
I think capacitance electronic discs are going to come back in a big way.
Beta,
like,
yeah.
In the future, when you want to watch Terminator 2, you're going to get out that laser disc and you're going to flip it halfway through the movie.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
As our ancestors intended.
Exactly.
No, actually, one thing I do want to say that I feel pretty strongly about the future of audio playback is actually about the devices we use themselves. I think we're going to continue to see a decoupling of the audio reading device from the actual device that produces the sound. So, for example, this exists today. You can get pretty good Bluetooth speakers or Bluetooth headphones. So you stream audio from the internet on your phone or your laptop or your TV, and then you listen to that audio through whichever speaker system.
The phone connects to a speaker system.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, yeah, you've synced to your player, the headphones, the whole speaker system, and, you know, that's bye-bye to the earbuds with the cords.
Yeah.
I think that's going to become pretty universal.
Sure. I mean, I have a Bluetooth headset that's meant for music and podcasts, that sort of thing, that uses bone conduction as well. So mm-hmm. it's not even over the ear, but it also doesn't have a cord or anything. I definitely see that trend continuing.
Oh, sure, sure. I think as the technology improves, probably your big clunky headset or small, sexy, slim headset will be the device that is streaming the media directly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I just see generally more ease of interconnectivity. So, like, as we have the Internet of Things entering our homes, more devices will be the sort of the digital basis of playback, and then you can sync them to whatever kind of thing it is that's making the actual noise.
Well, yeah, this kind of comes back to the idea of let's use Netflix as an example, where if I'm logged into my Netflix account and I'm watching Netflix on my phone, and then I go into my house and I want to turn on that same movie using a set-top box that's connected there. That's logged into my account as well. So when I start it, it picks up where I left off on my phone. This uninterrupted experience is also something I see continuing into the future. The interesting thing to me is that if you had asked me maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I would have thought that the standalone MP3 player would still remain king, because back then, streaming was not really the method. You would download, mm-hmm. and so you would keep everything on the memory of the device itself instead of it being cloud-based. And I would have said, this is how it's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And in fact, for the longest time, I carried an MP3 player and a phone I didn't want to clog up my phone's memory with media.
Right, right.
I still do.
Oh,
I have an MP3 player and a phone.
I've graduated. I only go phone now because I use the streaming method, so I'm not filling up my memory. The cache fills up so that if I do lose that connectivity, I can continue enjoying whatever it is I'm listening to or watching or reading. But it's not that I need to have a phone with practically endless amounts of storage, because that storage isn't needed anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that in general, across media, we're going to continue to see, like, you know, mid-sized portable devices, whether that's a tablet or a mini tablet or
phablet.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I have. I
don't, very large buttons on your coat that can play movies back to you. I don't know.
HoloLens
that are capable of handling both music and video and books and et cetera. And you know, doing the streaming thing. I don't know. Like I wonder whether at a certain point if like memory will become cheap enough that people will return to
having things stored on their phone.
Yeah.
It depends. If the service ends up being so seamless that it's not necessary, I don't think it's going to be a thing. But there are always going to be times, at least that I can see, where you are going to want to have things stored directly on the device itself. For example, if you take a flight somewhere and you don't want to spring for Wi-Fi on the flight. Plus, Wi-Fi on flights is never at the speed that you really
sure.
need.
Oh, sure. And I think that's a point. Like right now, cellular service isn't available everywhere. Wi-Fi can be spotty. You have to pay for them in many contexts. And so, therefore, streaming isn't quite ready
it's not super
pervasive.
Totally seamless. It all depends on where you live. Like, if you're in a city like Atlanta or San Francisco or New York, probably pretty good, but that's not universal.
Yeah, I would also add to that access anxiety. If you're interested mm-hmm. in something that is perhaps obscure, something you're not sure is going to continue to be provided by Netflix or whatever, you know.
That's a good point.
You think, well, you know, I don't know if this movie's still going to be on Netflix in a year when I want to watch it again. I'd rather just own the Blu-ray.
Right. I mean, if Tammy and the T-Rex goes away, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Me neither.
And what about books?
Right. So I think that more reading is going to be done digitally as prices on reading devices, electronic reading devices, drop.
Right.
And I suspect that in parallel, print prices are going to rise as printing runs get smaller as a result.
I see. So you're thinking of because the market is moving more digital, the potential market for actual physical books is getting smaller.
Mm-hmm.
That drives the prices up because you can no longer print in the volumes that you would before and expect a decent return on that investment.
Right.
The other way of looking at that is that they just keep the prices the same by cutting costs, and there will be more typos in your printed books.
Now, editor free.
I'm sorry, we only hired a copy editor for the digital version.
Like, Lauren, I liked your book, but the main character's name changed like six times.
That was part of the point, Jonathan.
These modern novels.
I'm actually, in thinking about this, I got this sudden moment of worry that some people might start to get priced out of easy access to print media due to the fact that, you know, from an entry standpoint, a paperback is a lot cheaper than a Kindle and probably will continue to be. Even though, you know, obviously getting a Kindle and having basically unlimited access to a lot of books for very cheap or even free in the case of classics.
Sure. Well, and I love the move to electronic media for another reason. It also gives us access to books that otherwise have passed out of print. They're not in the public domain. You still have to buy them. But I'm the son of an author. My dad has a horror novel that came out in the 80s, and it's my favorite book that my dad ever wrote. I love it. But it's not available in physical format anymore, but you can get it electronically. And that's something that I love. It means that people can have access to works that there's no reason from the publisher's standpoint to produce more.
Print.
Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah, there's
sure.
not enough. There's not a large enough market to justify it. Mm-hmm. But electronically, you can have anything out there.
Yes. Yes. And that is truly wonderful. And I wonder whether for like the generation being born right now.
Yeah.
Literally right now. I salute you.
Yeah. yeah. When you're old enough to listen to this, you'll appreciate that.
Yeah. whether for them, paper books and like paper printed magazines and newspapers are going to become a nostalgic, I don't want to say fetish, but like a nostalgic,
like an anachronism, some sort of
like a cassette
thing.
Tape
or a vinyl record. Yeah. If reading something on paper is going to be like, oh, I just love the ritual of opening a book.
You know, maybe this is I'm just far too technophobic, I guess, to be talking about technology all the time. I do admit I have a perhaps old fashioned preference for paper books. I don't have a tablet, but I don't think I would really like to read a book-length literary work on one. I'll read articles on the internet and stuff.
I got one of the touchscreen Kindles at some point, and I actually really like it. But I also did get the kind of case for it that's like made of wood and leather, and so you open it and you kind of feel like you're opening a book.
Hmm. Well, maybe I just need to get with the times.
Yeah. I will say that the move to digital formats for books also means that we'll have fewer head scratchingly odd moments in movies. Like, have you guys heard about the scene in the J-Lo film Boy Next Door?
Mm-hmm.
Where the boy next door hands her a quote first edition of the Iliad, end quote.
Well, hey, there have been lots of first editions of the Iliad.
That's the problem. Is that it's like they're joking that it's this valuable thing.
It should have been written on vellum.
Or it should have been a blind poet is what it should have been.
presents her with a poet.
Yeah, exactly. Who just starts reciting in Greek.
The first edition is the first time it's fixed in tangible medium.
Well, you know, if we go back into the brainwaves thing. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I think it was a great question. It was interesting. I do think that streaming for at least the foreseeable future is going to be the way to go. Maybe we'll eventually get to a point where things will get beamed directly into our brains and we will experience them instantaneously in their entirety.
I hope so. That would be such a time
saver. I could get through all of those books that are on my list in like no time flat.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your question, Ed. I think now we're going to move on to an email we got from our listener Jude about geothermal energy and space coordinates. So Jude says, hi there.
Hey, Jude.
Hey. Oh, no. I see what you did there.
Go ahead.
Jude says, hi there. I've been listening to your audio podcast. You guys are doing a great job. Thanks, Jude.
Thank you.
That warms my cold heart.
Yes.
your heart is very warm, Joe.
Well.
Okay, sorry. Back to the email.
Can you please cover the following topics? We all know Earth's core is molten rock and must be a source of massive untapped energy. Has anyone attempted to harness Earth's geothermal energy? And how do astronomers navigating the cosmos or refer to a star or object in space? Is there a GPS equivalent in space? Thanks a lot. From Jude in Bangalore.
So we're going to take these in turn. We'll start with geothermal. So first of all, geothermal energy is a thing.
Obviously,
something
yes,
that we harness. It doesn't involve tapping into the Earth's core directly. Although, as you'll see, there's kind of an indirect long-tail version of tapping into the Earth's core.
Mm-hmm.
Geothermal heat means thermal energy or heat from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that heat is generated primarily from two sources. One is that is the radioactive decay of materials that are in the Earth's crust. That accounts for about 80%, actually, of geothermal energy.
Really?
Yep.
I did not know that at all.
The other 20% comes from the geothermal gradient, which is the difference between the core's temperature and the planet's surface temperature. So you probably know heat conducts from high concentration to low concentration, right? And that means that heat is moving from the core out into the crust. So if you dig down far enough, the temperature starts to go up.
You know, I knew that, but I had no idea it had to do with this radioactive decay. I assumed that it was because of the pressure of the rock above it.
Well, radioactive decay is, again, just that that's part of what's generating heat. Because as we've talked about before, radioactive decay, that is one of the byproducts. But the actual heat from the core, that has nothing to do with the radioactivity. That's just basic physics of conduction. So as you drill down, that temperature goes up, and the average is 25 to 30 degrees Celsius per kilometer or 15 degrees Fahrenheit per 1,000 feet. Now, that's the average, because there are some areas where that gradient is much different. For example, if you're drilling near a volcano, you might notice that temperature goes way up, way faster. Magma will do that to you.
Yes.
So it's thought that this gradient actually decreases dramatically as you get through the crust and into the upper mantle. And the basis for that hypothesis is that if it were steady, if in fact you continue to see that rise in temperature every kilometer, then you would eventually, within the lithosphere, that's the area of the upper crust, not the upper crust, the crust of the upper mantle. The upper crust is a great band. If that remained steady, it would eventually hit the temperature where rock would melt before you got to a point where it's no longer solid. Like, we know that the crust and upper mantle are solid and brittle, and that's below that when you start hitting liquid.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the solid core when you get to the very center of the Earth. Because we know that this gradient has to level off at some point. It can't continue at that pace, or else the temperature would be too high for there to be a solid surface there or a solid material there. It'd have to be liquid. So this is still just a hypothesis, however. We don't really know what the actual conditions under the surface of the Earth are, because we haven't had direct observation of it.
Yes, spoiler alert, Jules Verne wrote fiction.
Yes, did not really go to the center of the Earth. The deepest hole that humans have ever drilled is the Kola Superdeep Borehole in Russia.
It's one of my favorite things.
It is.
That's a great name for a thing. Anyway, go ahead.
There's a great video that shows exactly where it is, and it just looks like a little metal plate.
Just a pipe sticking out of the ground.
It's a metal plate on top of that pipe that is welded and bolted onto it. So, you know, but it looks like you could otherwise just pick it up.
You can't throw pennies down there.
No. Yeah, you can't. Like, wait, let's see. Let's listen for the drop. So this thing is super deep, as the name implies. It's 12,000, actually doesn't imply it, as the name states. It is 12,262 meters or 40,230 feet deep.
I remember I wrote a video about this.
And I did the video.
Yeah, and I did some math and found out. Now that I'm sitting here, I don't remember the number, but I calculated how long it would take you to hit the bottom if you could fall down this tiny narrow shaft. It would take you a long time.
Right. And you know, that is very deep, obviously, but it's not deep enough to even come close to breaching the crust and going into the upper mantle. The crust is, on average, underneath the continents anyway, 32 kilometers thick, or 25 miles.
Oof.
This thing went 12.2 kilometers down, so not even halfway. Now, if we were to dig a similar hole in the ocean floor, we might actually break through to the mantle, because the crust along the ocean floor is around 8 kilometers thick on average. But then you'd have to get down to the ocean floor.
Yeah.
So you'd have to deal with that. But at any rate, we haven't even breached the crust to get to the mantle. So we haven't gotten close to the core, to get back to the, to Jude's question. We haven't gotten close enough so that we could tap into the core's energy directly.
Okay. So the core is pretty much a no-go. And I would guess even in the future, we're not going to get direct access to the core just because of like the heat and pressure involved. Once you get even a tiny fraction of the way down there would kind of make access ridiculous.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, I've heard that when the super deep hole was being, when the borehole was being drilled, that by the time they ended the project, they described the rocks as behaving more like plastic than rock. Ooh. That it was deforming with the drill bit, which was making it harder to actually drill.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also if you got to the mantle, that's 2,900 kilometers thick. That's before you hit the core. So we're talking peanuts here.
Yeah.
Like, we are nowhere close to the core yet. But one cool thing I think about this is that if in fact we haven't drilled down and we haven't had any direct observation, how do we know that the mantle is the way it is or that the core is the way it is? And the answer is we look from other sources, for example, and indirect sources. So meteorites, for example, by looking at the composition of the material in meteorites, we start to draw conclusions about what our own planet is like. So, for example, we have seen a lot of meteorites that have rock in them and fewer that have iron in them, which starts to have us draw the conclusion that iron, at least in certain forms, is probably going to be at the core of a planet. It's going to make up a smaller portion. It's going mm-hmm. to be at the center.
Mm-hmm.
And that rock is going to make up a lot much larger proportion of that.
Right. We can also guess at the iron content of the Earth's core due to the way that the magnetosphere is set up.
That's also true. And mm-hmm. we can observe volcanic eruptions and see the material that is spewed out because volcanoes extend down. The magma can extend down all the way down into the mantle. So that gives us, when it starts spewing forth, a closer picture of what's inside underneath there. Also, studying seismic waves, earthquakes, by looking at how they propagate. So let's say a seismic wave occurs in San Francisco, and you look on the other side of the world and you detect how those vibrations go through when they eventually pass through there. Because we're talking about super sensitive equipment looking at this. By measuring the amount of time and the direction that it came from and the frequency of the waves, we can learn more about the medium or media that it passed
through. It's traveled, right?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's, I keep thinking, like, this is amazing that we've learned so much through indirect observation. So, cool question.
Yeah, definitely. Though one more thing about this question is that despite the fact that we're not getting it from the core of the Earth, geothermal energy is totally real. That's a power source.
Yeah, it's a renewable, clean power source.
I've heard that I think some people do have certain concerns about it because the main version I know about is steam powered, basically, like you're injecting water into hot places and then using the rising steam to power a turbine. There might be other ways of doing it, but I know I've read some people being concerned like, oh, is this safe to do? Is it going to cause earthquakes or something? But as far as we know,
yeah,
seems like it's a pretty good power source.
That's definitely the main way that we generate electricity, right? I mean, we've talked about a lot of different methods to generate electricity, and they almost always come down to, I almost said boil down to, come down to steam turning a turbine. That pretty much is the way that we generate electricity for the most part. And now Jude's second question was about celestial coordinates, really, or typically it was about how do astronauts navigate through space, how do astronomers say where a star is located. And here's the thing, guys. The main way that astronomers describe the location of stars is based largely off a similar way that we describe where something is on the surface of the Earth.
Mm.
It's like looking at the sky as if it were an enormous sphere that completely encircled our globe. So it's like our globe is inside an even bigger globe, which has little pinpoints in it.
Which may or may not have been what people literally thought a few thousand years ago.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that remains the basis, the main way that astronomers end up giving coordinates to stars. Now, there are a couple of others that we could talk about besides the one I'm going to focus on. Like there's the galactic method of coordinates and supergalactic method, which is looking at stars from the perspective of, say, our sun, or the center of the Milky Way. But for the most part, in astronomical circles, both in the amateur and professional world, we're looking at celestial coordinates, which are much more Earth-based. And that makes sense because that's where we're looking at them from.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I can see how this would actually matter in the future. Like if we encounter an alien species and we're trying to communicate with them about where something is.
Like, all right. So if you're standing in Times Square, it's like right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't help. So on Earth, we have the human defined imaginary lines of longitude and latitude. That's part of our geographic coordinate system. So the vertical lines are longitude, the meridians. And then the horizontal lines, the ones that are in parallel with the equator, that's latitude. And your coordinates are determined by where you are in relation to those lines. And the values are represented in units of degrees, minutes, and seconds. Or, and this is becoming more and more common with GPS devices, decimal degrees. So the equator is at 0 degrees latitude. And if you travel north or south, you increase that latitude, either north latitude or south latitude, from 0 to 90 degrees. So North Pole is 90 degrees north, South Pole is 90 degrees south. The Greenwich Meridian represents 0 degrees longitude, and longitude extends 100 degrees to the east and 180 degrees to the east and 180 degrees to the west. So 180 east and 180 west are the same. It's the same line that's on the opposite side of the world from the Greenwich Meridian. Do you happen to know what that line is?
Somewhere in the Pacific Ocean.
You're correct on that. Do you know what specifically it is? The International Date Line.
Oh.
That's why if you go to Australia from here, you lose a day. It's like a day never existed, which one of our coworkers just got to experience. He's in Australia now. Hi, Josh. How you doing? Anyway, so why do we describe it in minutes and seconds with degrees? What's the deal with that? So along the equator, 1 hour of the rotation of the Earth is equivalent to 15 degrees of rotation. Now, if you look at a circle and you divide up the circle into 15, you know, increments of 15 degrees, you get 24. 24 hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, the 15 degrees of rotation. So if you look at lines of longitude, you'll see that there are 15 degree increments normally between these. So 1 second of time is equal more or less to about a quarter of a mile of rotation at the equator. And the degrees can be subdivided into minutes and seconds this way, 60 minutes to a degree, 3,600 seconds to a degree. And now we take that same system, the latitude and longitude, and we blow up that globe so it's this celestial sphere that encompasses our planet.
Right.
And we just create a celestial equator. We take where our equator is on our Earth, extend that outward as if it just continues. This imaginary line continues out into space. And now we have a larger imaginary line that's linked to our equator, that's the celestial equator.
Mm-hmm. But at that point, we don't call it latitude and longitude anymore.
No, we do not, because, I mean, you know, we need to make things confusing, right? So instead of latitude, we have lines of declination, and lines of longitude become right ascension. So the zero for longitude, or right ascension, really, is the first point of Aries. So right ascension is described in hours, minutes, and seconds instead of degrees because the passing of stars was a means of measuring time back in the olden days, and it stuck. So if you use this equatorial coordinate system, you would refer to a star's position relative to the celestial equator, that's the lines of declination, and where it is relative to zero right ascension, which is the point on the celestial equator where the sun would cross the celestial equator during the vernal equinox.
Sure.
Is it simple enough for you yet? All right. So Polaris would be at 2 hours, 31 minutes, right ascension, 89 degrees, 15 arc minutes declination, which is, you know, easy as pie. But what happens now, this is a fixed system because it's based upon this imaginary equator, right? That's going to be the same for anyone anywhere on Earth. I have to stress on Earth, obviously. If you were on some other planet, then this system would totally not make any sense to you. But what if you, Joe, wanted to tell somebody where to find a particular celestial body and, you know, referring to the celestial equator is not really convenient because it's not like we have a bright line across the sky that says, hey, here's the celestial equator. You would describe the altitude of the star, which is how many degrees above the horizon it is. By the way, a degree is essentially, if you hold out your thumb, the thickness, the width of your thumb is essentially 1 degree. And if you hold out your hand, I think that's like more like 15. It's kind of interesting.
Some thumbs are thicker than others.
Yeah, so your degrees may vary.
But your arm is longer, so.
So the perspective makes it all work out.
But if you have short arms and thick thumbs, you're in a pickle.
You're a bad, bad astronomer.
Yeah, you have no business looking at the sky. Look to your feet. At any rate, how many degrees above the horizon is the altitude? And then you have to describe the azimuth of the star.
The azimuth.
That's how many degrees along the horizon with respect to the to a compass direction. So you start from north. North is 0 degrees. And then you go clockwise. So east would be 90 degrees, because that's a right angle from north. South is 180 degrees. West is 270 degrees. And this method of describing a star's position is completely dependent upon the point of reference of the observer.
Yeah. Right. I wouldn't be able to say, oh, hey, my friend in Alaska.
Right.
Look at this star. It's right there.
30 exactly. thumbs and five yeah. hands to the right.
Exactly. That wouldn't work. Now, if you were to use the other method I mentioned before with the celestial equator, first of all, you both have access to math and abilities that I don't know about because I can't figure this stuff out on my own. But that would work because that's a fixed system. But
right.
the one that requires the point of view of the observer, obviously that would not work in that instance. You're exactly right. So also this means that this system's not terribly useful once you get significantly far enough away from Earth. Now, most of our manned missions have been really close to Earth. I mean, low Earth orbit. Even going out to the moon is not that far in celestial terms.
Yeah, yeah. You're still in orbit of the Earth.
Yeah. So the big problem is that if you're talking about interstellar travel, this system's not useful. For one thing, it has nothing to do with the distance of stars. This is just their relative position within the view of the night sky from Earth. So two stars that look close together because they seem to be close together in that imaginary sphere could be incredibly far apart in distance. One could be deeper than another, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it would be much further away. It's so the constellations are very, very deceptive in that sense. You know, the stars that appear to be close together might be very far away from one another. Now, keeping that in mind, how do we help spacecraft that go beyond this? Because we have had unmanned spacecraft that went beyond Earth orbit. And one of the tools we use is called the Deep Space Network, or DSN. It's a network of three powerful radio antenna. They're positioned around the world in such a way that together they have total coverage of the sky. So those three points mean that we can send and receive messages from any angle off the Earth.
The sun never sets on the Deep Space Network.
That's mm-hmm. correct. Yes.
So, and this was set up during, I believe, the late 1960s?
Yeah, this actually ended up becoming, came into effect just before the Apollo missions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it ended up making another navigation system that was originally going to be the primary navigation system aboard the Apollo the secondary or backup system, because now they could do all the calculations from
the
Earth.
Ground. Yeah.
So obviously, if you're making calculations from Earth, it doesn't matter if it's an Earth-centric thing, as long as it still applies to whatever body happens to be out there in space. And in fact, these radio antenna, what they do is they send out a signal and then they wait to get a return signal from the spacecraft. And based on the time it takes from the moment of transmission to the moment of receiving that return signal, as well as the shift in frequencies, the eggheads who crunch the numbers can figure out how quickly that spacecraft is moving, where it is, like to an incredible degree of precision.
So yeah. Like Jude asked, it kind of is like GPS in space.
Kind
yeah.
of, but only for spacecraft, right?
Yeah.
It's only for something that can radio back to us.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like GPS for your car,
right.
But in space.
Yeah. It doesn't apply to stars, but it applies to spacecraft. So it's something like the accuracy, we can figure out the velocity to 0.05 meters per second, and we can figure out the location within 3 meters. So it's even more accurate than some GPS devices are. Just pretty phenomenal when you think of a tiny, relatively tiny item in space that is passing possibly outside of the solar system, because this is how we contact things like the Voyager probes. So it's pretty cool. Now, if we ever reach a time when interstellar travel is common, we'll have to create something called star maps or star charts that are accurate representations of the relationships of various stars, how far away they are in three dimensions, not just in two.
Yeah, I can imagine it being very difficult, because when you think about maps of the Earth's surface that we're used to, these are basically two-dimensional. I mean, they might have topographical information on them.
Yeah.
But they're two-dimensional planes.
Yeah, we've never had to think about space in three dimensions before. It's all been like Star Trek, where all the ships just come directly.
They're always level.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And even in, say, like video games, where you're supposed to navigate a galaxy, I'm thinking of like in the Mass Effect games, mm-hmm. or something like that, you typically get like a top-down view of the galaxy that's still a two-dimensional map. You know, you're looking down on it and everything's arranged on the same two-dimensional XY-axis plane.
Right.
But if you were actually navigating, you'd be moving to and past and through your points of reference for where you were.
Well, and not only that, but the place you're leaving from and the place you're going to are also in motion.
Yeah.
Right? They're not standing still. So you wouldn't just be planning where you're headed. You have to plan where is your destination going to be by the time you get to where you need to go.
Right.
So this is a grand scale of the kind of calculations astronauts have to make and ground control has to make when launching something to, say, Mars, where, you know, we talked about how to get to Mars, it takes between like 6 and 8 months to get there, because you're not launching to where Mars is. You have to launch to where Mars is going to be. Same sort of thing here, but now on an interstellar level, which makes it even more complicated.
Really, really complex bocce.
And in fact, the references I was looking at said, you know, we just don't have the information yet to create something that would be good for navigational purposes. A lot of this would be stuff that would have to be done in exploratory missions, where it would be kind of like the early explorers who would set off in ships across the ocean, not knowing where they were going or when they would get there, and then having to map everything out. Similar in that respect, but on an even grander scale, obviously. So pretty interesting. And there's also something cool I wanted to mention. Lauren, you discovered this, actually. I remember Joe was telling me about astronauts using sextants on board spacecraft.
Sextants, of course, being the, if you're unaware of them, the old nautical
tool
where you, it looks a little bit like a protractor, except you sight along it.
Right.
And
yeah, you have to take, you take the horizon as a reference and another body like the sun as a reference, and you do some calculations to determine where in relation to the rest of the planet you happen to be.
Uh-huh.
The astronauts did the same thing. They had a tool that,
they didn't have a protractor looking thing.
No, theirs was,
they weren't peeking out the window.
Theirs was like a pair of telescopes that were connected to a very sophisticated, at the time, device, that was in a fixed position, by the way, so they couldn't move it. You had to move the spacecraft to look at the star you wanted to look at.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they had it was to correct for drift, right? They would plan their trajectory and they would check to make sure that they were still on the trajectory that they had planned. So what they would do is they would sight two different celestial bodies, or they would use the Earth's horizon or the moon's horizon as one of the reference points, and then a star. And then they would make sure that it lined up properly. And if it lined up properly, they knew that they were on the right trajectory. If it was out of alignment, they knew that they were drifting and they had to do a course correction to get that fixed. And one of the descriptions I read of how the system ultimately worked was really cool. So they would pick a star and say, all right, we want star whatever. And they'd put that into the computer saying, this is the star we're going to use as our reference point. The spacecraft would orient itself to turn toward that star. Then they would look through the sextant, and the sextant has little crosshairs on it. And if the star is not in the center of the crosshairs, they knew that they had drifted. They use controls on the sextant to move the crosshairs over the star, push a button. That sends a command to the navigation system to do a course correction so that the thrusters then do the necessary thrusting to put them back on the correct course and correct for drift. And I read this and I thought, That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And this was actually in use in several of the Apollo missions. I think as late as Apollo 8, they had a big mission. That's the one that went around the backside of the moon.
The dark side.
Yeah. Which
not
is really,
really, the dark side.
Really
no.
quite bright.
The
at
far,
certain times.
The far side of the moon.
Yes.
But yes.
And I think that the astronaut who specifically was using it was an ex-naval officer. So it was kind of appropriate.
Probably had his little bosun's whistle there too and everything.
I'm sure.
Stroke.
But obviously if you're talking about a spacecraft that goes outside the view of the Earth, then you want to have this backup system, clearly, because
you
aren't certain yet. You can't be absolutely sure that the Earth-based navigational systems will stay in constant contact, because once you get behind the moon, that's a pretty big obstacle to block your radio communication. So it is clear why they needed to have a secondary navigational tool aboard to make sure they could correct for things like drift.
Okay, well, those are the only three questions we have time for in this episode, but rest assured we will be getting back to more of your questions and suggestions in a subsequent Listener Mail Roundup episode.
Yeah, this has been so much fun.
Yeah.
But one last message I wanted to end with, just because it's very brief and we can squeeze it in. It was some wonderful feedback on our Back to the Future episodes, and this came from Steven on email. He said, I think you missed one important detail in your two Back to the Future podcasts. The reason why we don't have all the new technologies, I'm sure he was talking about the things we were all disappointed not to have yet, like hoverboards and telescoping baseball bats.
Right.
He says, the reason we don't have those things is that lawyers were never outlawed. That is why Marty's kids were convicted so quickly. Thank you, Steven.
Yeah, thanks, Steven.
Thank you, Steven.
I forgot that salient point from Back to the Future Part 2. Lawyers had been outlawed, and therefore the court systems moved much more
very, very quickly.
Yes.
But
yeah.
Wait a minute. What does that have to do with the technologies? Well, I feel like I'm faintly grasping Stephen's point, but I'm not quite there.
What he's saying is that because this one element of the future has not come true, the other elements can't come true.
And also, without lawyers, everything would move more quickly.
Yeah, first of all, you wouldn't
Sorry, lawyers. It's just true.
Oh, well, yeah. we did just talk about intellectual property
and
the chilling effect of patent law and stuff.
That's true. So, yeah, anyway, this was so much fun. Thank you guys so much. We're very much looking forward to doing this again. We do have other questions,
yeah.
Some of which we have already started to research and talk about offline. So keep those coming in, because we're having a great time. Some of these are going to be full episodes. Some are going to be like this one, where we collect some of the various questions that don't quite make up a full episode. And it's fantastic. It lets us know what you guys are interested in, and we're so excited to cover that. In order to let us know what you would like us to talk about, you should send us an email. That address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking. Over on Facebook, just search FW Thinking. We'll pop right up. Leave us a message. Tell us what you think. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.